Welcome to another day, another talk. Today is Tuesday, right? So this is the fourth or fifth or sixth or third or talk, something like that. In a series of talks on meditation. And we've done lots of talks on meditation so far. And I've talked about the breath meditation so far. But I haven't talked about Anapanasati yet. So today, we're going to talk about Anapanasati. I'm going to say a few things about how the Buddha taught meditation. And it will help sort of give some extra reinforcement to what I've said already. And also to give a few more tips on how to get these deep states of meditation. How to have it all buzzing along nice and beautifully, happily, peacefully, clearly. So today's talk is on how the Buddha taught meditation. And as many of you know, the Buddha became enlightened under the Bodhi tree by doing Anapanasati. Now, there's another type of meditation which is very close to Anapanasati, which I do not recommend. I call it Anapanasati. Because Anapanasati, pana means the breath, ana means along with, sati means mindfulness, mindfulness along with the breath. And the other type of meditation, Anapanasati, is meditation along with the pain. And that's not a good thing to do. Because what happens is you just get really negative. You don't get any fun, you don't get any happiness. And as will become very clear in this morning's talk, that's not the way which leads to samadhi, which leads to peace, which leads to insight, which leads to enlightenment. Following the path of pain only gets you into depression, frustration, anxiety, and all those negative things which you have enough of already. You don't need to come to a meditation retreat to experience all those things. So, this is the way the Buddha taught meditation. And in the Anapanasati Sutta, he, first of all, sometimes people come to my retreat and say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, he only talks about samatha. And I like to do vipassana. I like to do the four satipatthanas. But the first thing to say about Anapanasati is the Buddha made it very clear when he said specifically that anyone who fulfills the 16 factors of Anapanasati thereby fulfills the practice of the four satipatthanas. So in order to fulfill the four satipatthanas, the Buddha said, just do the 16 practices of Anapanasati, and you do both at the same time. So this is one of those efficiency retreats. You can do satipatthana and samatha exactly at the same time. Anapanasati and vipassana, all going together. And this is the words of the Buddha, not the words of Ajahn Brahm, not the words of this sayadaw or that monk. This is the word of the boss, the Buddha. To do Anapanasati fulfills the four satipatthanas. So what did he say about the Anapanasati? First of all, you have to develop mindfulness. Number one. Even before you start watching the breath, he said, make sure you sit in a quiet place and have mindfulness in front of you. And that particular statement, because it's not really part of the 16 steps, because it's only like a prologue, many people, they just disregard that. They're not quite sure what it means. And I think that some of you have found, by the way I've taught in this retreat, that developing a little bit of present moment awareness and silence, first of all, makes it much easier to watch the breath. And the reason why people find it hard to do breath meditation, they just jump right into it before doing the preparation. It's like you're painting a wall of your house. If you don't scrub it down, first of all, to get all the grease off it, if you don't get off all the flaky bits, then if you paint, you'll never get a good job. As every painter will tell you, preparation is the most important part. The same as doing breath meditation. Preparation is the most important part. So you sit in a comfortable position, so it's not too much pain, no anapanasati. And then you start to bring mindfulness in front of you. In other words, you arouse this mindfulness. Present moment awareness and silence arouses mindfulness for the one reason, as I've mentioned before, I'll say it again, when the energy starts going into doing, you lose your mindfulness. mindfulness gets weak and starts to go all over the place. Too much controlling, too much doing. Hopefully that you've all got that point by now. You've all seen what happens when you strive. You had those experiences when you've given up, you've let go, and things start to come together. You know that controlling is the opposite. When you control, not only do you spread mindfulness all over the place, but you weaken it. When you let go, you rest, the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and stronger. Which is interesting. It means that by the end of this retreat, if you've really been following the instructions, whether you think you're a good meditator or not, what happens is the mindfulness increases. You get more and more sensitive. The lights of the mind go up. And if you don't get to superpower mindfulness, at least you get to power mindfulness. And when you get to power mindfulness, you find watching the breath is much easier. The reason is because your eyes are wide open. The eyes of the mind are open. So you can see much more of what's going on in there. And also the other part about establishing mindfulness is when you establish a little bit of mindfulness, you get a little bit of happiness. Because the mind gets energized, it gets joyful, and then you can watch subtle things like the breath. But most people, the only thing they can watch is things which give you happiness, in the sense of like movies or sport or whatever. Something which just sort of supply that by themselves. But they're not very useful for you. When you do something like the breath, why don't you get into this power of mindfulness? Whatever you see is beautiful. It's as if the mind is giving you that beauty, that energy, not the thing in itself. It's supplied from within. You're not borrowing it from somebody else or from some other thing. So here you find out, once you really get mindful, whatever you look at gets interesting. Whatever you eat becomes delicious. Whatever you do tends to become fun. Even I've noticed at the end of the retreat or towards the end of the retreat, even ordinary jokes seem exceedingly funny. Why is that? The same old jokes. But your mindfulness has increased and you're more happy. You're more willing to laugh. So the theory goes anyway. So what that means is the happiness of life is coming from within you. Life is not supplying it to you. Is coming from within you. So it means that if you're going to watch something like the breath towards the end of the retreat, it's much easier than from the beginning. Number one, the mindfulness is strong. Number two, it supplies happiness to whatever it watches. And so it's nice, it's fun to watch the breath. Not only that, when the energy gets even better, more strong, you can watch even more subtle objects. Things which usually you're too blind to see. Things like the nimitta, things like jhanas. The mindfulness is strong enough now to see those things before you've been walking in the mist. You've been walking in the dark. Those things have been lurking in the shadows. Sometimes a nimitta comes up when you're least expecting it, like a little phantom in the forest, but then it disappears straight away because the lights of the mind aren't strong enough yet to really see them and understand them and accept them and be with them. So the first thing with Anapanasati is to develop mindfulness. And whether you think you've been practicing or not practicing, you think you've been lazy or think you've been diligent, you think you've been successful or you've been a complete waste of time, it does not matter. You have developed an increase in your mindfulness. You are more alert, more awake. If the food tastes delicious, then you know it's working. So, that's the first stage of the Anapanasati, the preliminary stage. And I've run through these reasonably quickly to get to the interesting parts. Because once you have mindfulness, you sit down, you just watch your breath. And the first two stages say you see if it's a long breath or you see if it's a short breath, that's all. That just makes it a little bit interesting. In other words, you play around with it. It doesn't have to be, you know, in breath or... So it doesn't have to be a long breath or a short breath. It can be a middle breath. It can be all sorts of breaths. You can mess around. Which is why that I encourage people at that particular stage to do things like breathing backwards. Or somebody reminded me today, another method which I said, breathe in three times and then breathe out once. I guess fun, it's something to do, isn't it? Or breathe in once and out three times. (Laughter) And see, I proved it. The stupid things you can laugh at now. It shows your mindfulness is increasing. So the point of the matter is, you're playing around with the breath, making it interesting, giving something to give it some texture, some interest. So instead of just watching the old breath in, out, in, out, in, out, you make fun with it. You can do all sorts of other things with the breath at these first two stages of meditation. You don't have to do what stage one and then stage two, or stage two and then stage one, because it's just those two are like complementary stages. Is it a short breath? Is it a long breath? Is it rough? Is it smooth? You know, do it, count the breath if you want, or breathe in three times and then out once, or whatever it is you do, just to make it a bit more interesting. And after a while, when it gets interesting, the mind sort of gets into the breath because it's not doing anything else. Because it's just staying with the breath, there's not much you can do with the breath. It means it's a simple object, it's focusing. Because of its simplicity, because you can't do very much, your mindfulness increases even more. You can hold an ordinary object, a simple object, a subtle object. And after a while you can stop all the fun and games about breathing in once, breathing out three times or whatever it is, or breathing backwards or counting the breaths or wondering whether it's so long or smooth. And then you just know the breath without playing around with it. Just the breath by itself is enough to keep your attention. And that gets out of the third stage of the meditation, to know the whole breath. What happens, because you're watching the breath, the whole thing sort of expands, and you can see the whole breath from the very beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath, the beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath. You can even see the gaps between the breaths. Which gap is longer? Have you found out yet? The gap between the in-breath and the out-breath, or the gap between the out-breath and the in-breath? Which for you is longer? And those sensations of breathing, is it like a sort of like one of these like sine curves? It goes up to its peak and then it slowly descends in intensity. Or is it like it goes up and then suddenly stops? What type of breath have you got? After a while, you get fascinated with this breath. In very much the same way when you do walking meditation, those people do the slow walking meditation. After a while, you know, instead of just doing, you know, left, right, start to see one left step. It's amazing all the things going on when you're just moving one foot. The way all those muscles, you can feel every muscle start to move as you lift the foot off the grass. You can see just the way it curves upwards and moves backwards. The whole thing is just full of interest. There's so much going on there. And just one step fills the whole mind until you put it down on the grass again and you can feel the soft grass under your feet, and then the hard earth underneath. Wow, that's interesting. You see so much more. In the walking meditation, just one step fills the whole mind. And in the same way, this third stage of the meditation is when the whole breath fills the mind, from the very beginning to the end of an each in-breath, the very beginning to the end of the out-breath, you see the whole lot. Don't miss anything. And it's not through force. It's just because the breath starts to become interesting. It starts to become even beautiful. It's interesting watching this. The mindfulness is so strong, you can see something so simple as a breath and see all of its wonderful characteristics. Sees the beauty in the ordinary. And once you can do this, that's the third stage of the meditation. Just sitting there, just watching the breath go in and go out. Go in and go out so wonderfully, so beautifully. And you're happy meditating. Some of you had those experiences, but you know they only happen when you relax and let go. If you try and say, right, that's that first stage of meditation, now I'm going to go for that. This meditation I'm going to do stage three. Don't be stupid. That's not the way these things happen. These things don't go according to your schedule or your agenda. When these stages are ready, they just happen. And they're all within the one which preceded it. You're just watching the breath, maybe playing around with it, then you just let it go, you just see the breath, and the whole thing starts to calm down, and it happens by itself. So know what's happening there when you get to that third stage, full attention on the breath. Naturally, what happens next is the whole breath calms down. It's a fourth stage. Instead of being like a rough breath, it becomes very smooth and very light. Instead of having all these extras like in or out, long or short, those disappear, and you're just left with with the breath, the essence of the breath, the heart of the breath. And here you're just sitting here and you're just watching. You're breathing in, breathing out. So peaceful, so quiet. And it's by itself, that's almost worth the whole retreat just to get to that stage. Because it makes your whole body be peaceful, be calm, be light. It's such a wonderful thing. It's just getting to those first stages, that's the hard part. Once you get to those first stages of meditation, the other stages, they just snowball very quickly sometimes. Because the next stage after you've got just the, you've calmed down the breath. You haven't calmed down the breath has become calm. Then these fifth and sixth stages, which, again, need to be emphasized on every retreat. They need to be emphasized to every meditator. Even some meditation teachers forget these two factors of the Anapanasati. As you're meditating on the breath, joy and happiness arise. In fact, you look out for those, you cultivate the joy and happiness along with the breath. This is where the breath becomes very much fun, joyful, delightful. Sometimes people say that if you ever get any fun in your meditation, that's the wrong path. You get attached. And that's wrong. The Buddha kept on saying that no, you should get attached to those states. These are the states of happiness. These are the things which are allowed to meditators, to enjoy. This is nature. When the mind gets very peaceful and you're watching the breath, it does become naturally peaceful, beautiful. When this happens, don't run away from the peace and the beauty. This is supposed to happen. It's part of the meditation. It's part of the stages, the fifth and sixth stages, where you're watching the breath become just so beautiful, just so nice. You get this inner joy. Now that inner joy is what really I call that beautiful breath. You're watching the breath, but it becomes just so lovely, so nice, that sometimes you wonder if you're watching the breath or you're watching the beauty. But both of them seem to sort of intertwine, and you can't distinguish one from the other. And you're having a great time by this stage. It's the beauty, the joy of just being peaceful. The mindfulness has got strong enough to energize itself. And you're just having fun. And it's those stages where people just can meditate for long periods of time. And it becomes effortless. Effortless because you don't need to do anything anymore. The joy, the happiness holds you. It's just something you just love to do. Just like eating, or like sleeping, or whatever else you like doing. You don't have to force yourself. And so it starts to become great fun. Now that's important to try and allow meditators to experience that much success in your meditation. Because once you get to the fun meditations, then you're hooked for life. In other words, you don't meditate because it's something you're supposed to do to keep yourself fit and stress-free. It's not like exercise, which you know, grit your teeth and decide to do it. This is actually something which the mind leaps towards, wants to do. You can't get enough of it. You get up in the morning. Once you get to these stages, you get up in the morning. Oh, it's only 3 o'clock. Great, an extra hour. Marvelous. You don't go 3 o'clock. Oh, no. Am I going to get to sleep in time and get up at 4 o'clock afterwards? It's actually the mind wants to meditate more and more because it's getting a lot of fun out of it. Now this is an important stage because this is what meditation is all about. The joy of the mind, the happiness inside. It's why meditation has lasted for so long. Why people become monks and nuns for the fun of it. For the joy. I tell people, I'm a hedonist. I'm into pleasure. The pleasure of the mind. So it's not like monks are just running away from pleasure. It's not that nuns are afraid of happiness. It's not as if we're trying to sort of do some sort of life penance, you know, to whatever, you know, to try and sort of absolve our sins because we've been really bad and mean, so off to a nunnery with you. That's not it. We're doing this for fun, for joy. And once you get into this stage of meditation, meditation is just so much fun. And it's also, it gives you a lot of therapeutical benefits because you're just really relaxed, having a good time. Negativity, anger, and all that sort of stuff just can't coexist with you. Now, if you had a good meditation, you're just so happy, you're just so smiley, you can't get angry at anybody. People can call you camel face and you say, yeah, that's me. Whatever, it doesn't matter, you make a joke about it, no one can upset you, life can't hurt you, because you've got this incredibly positive attitude built up from that power, that joy. So it's important to get to those stages. The next thing which happens, what's happening now, is the breath is becoming beautiful and wonderful. The next stage is when the whole thing calms down. When it says calming down, always understand that whatever calms down starts to disappear. Next stage is feeling the whole. They call this actually a chitta sankhara, this happiness and peace. And this is an important thing to know for those of you who know what actually is that happiness, that joy. Is it part of the breath? And said, no, it's made by the mind. It's the mind made happiness and peace. In other words, it comes from within you. It's not inherent in your breath. It's just the way it's what you imbue onto the breath because of the power of your mind. That's why it's called a chitta sankhara. The breath itself is called a kaya sankhara. It's a formation of the body. But the joy and peace is a formation of the mind. The mind is brightening up and making it look beautiful. So you understand and experience the joy and the bliss together, the beautiful breath. And then quite naturally it calms down. The breath starts to disappear, it gets ever more subtle. At this particular stage, so what actually happens sometimes is the breath changes so much from what you'd normally know of the breath. It's just like when I used to watch, Star Trek. I think that captain? Captain Kirk would say to, no, not Captain, it was not Bones, the doctor? No, Doctor, but the, Bones? Was it Bones or Spock? No, not Spock, it was the, anyway, the guy used to sort of check these planets and say, Captain, it's life, but not as we know it. Who's that? I don't know, I just a long time ago. Anyway, who cares? Anyway, this is meditation. But anyway, it's just like, it's life, but not as we know it. It's the breath, Captain, but not as we know it. That's what happens. That's the whole point of that anecdote, which I messed up. Anyway, never mind. This is what happens. You're watching the breath, and it is the breath, but not as you know it. So what is actually happening there, the breath has actually changed, it's morphed into something very subtle, but it is the breath you're watching at that particular state. And this is where you've got to be sharp. Having that bit of information from a teacher really helps, because it happened to me many times, you're watching the breath, you're getting very, very peaceful, then it disappeared and you got sort of confused. I'm supposed to be watching the breath, but I can't find it. And because you got confused, you messed up the whole meditation, disturbed yourself, and the whole thing fell apart. Now I know. But when the ordinary breath disappears, what's left is the subtle breath. When something is gone, you are actually watching, but not recognizing the more subtle breath. Another way of looking at it is that the breath can be noticed through two of the senses. It can be known through the sense of feeling, physical feeling. You feel the physical breath. But it can also be known through the sense door of the mind. You just know the breath without feeling it. It's the same breath, but you're seeing it through a different sense. And this is also what happens at this stage. You're not feeling the breath through the body. You're knowing the breath through the mind. And so it appears slightly different. And that's why people think they've lost the breath. You haven't lost the breath. You've lost the physical feeling of the breath. And you've gained the mental knowing of the breath. That's what it is. These are subtle stages. Now I've given you the clue. When your breath disappears, don't worry about it. What's left is the breath. But now you're not feeling it. You're knowing it. And it looks and experiences very different. It's also much more fun. It is when the breath calms down. The next thing which happens, you've got this beautiful breath and it's calming down. These stages should usually be really beautiful. If they're not enough happiness and bliss, the next stage you just go into a peaceful stage, but you can't go any further. Because there's not enough oomph to your mindfulness yet. Which is why it's important, those stages of having this beautiful, happy breath, lots of joy, lots of happiness in your meditation is crucial. It's a power which can take you deeper. Just being peaceful is not enough. You've got to be blissfully peaceful. In other words, that peace is energized. So, quite a lot of time, the reason why people get stuck in just peace without getting the beautiful peace is because they don't value the joy and happiness in their meditation enough. In fact, too often we think it's wrong, so we don't develop it. We get a little bit of happiness coming up and we think, oh, this can't be right. You don't indulge in it. Which is why you should, when peace and happiness come up in your meditation, indulge in it. Even almost thinking, wow, this is nice. Oh, yeah, I'm getting into this. Get into it. Don't push it away. Fascinating just how human beings, especially those who have been conditioned by the West, are afraid of happiness. You are afraid of happiness. You're afraid of pleasure. You know why? Because a lot of time, when you have that degree of happiness and pleasure, you feel you're completely out of control. You're more used to controlling when things are going wrong. When things are going right, wow, what can I do about this? Except spoil it. So it's all about this controlling business and ego and me and mine and I'm in charge of all this. The more you let go, the more you can just renounce and just say, oh, who cares, I'm just going to give up. The more that happiness comes and you give up and allow that happiness to take control, you are not the driver. The happiness and joy becomes the driver. And so that when that breath becomes so subtle and that the joy and the happiness is just still strong, you get to this amazing ninth stage of Anapanasati, as the Buddha taught it. A ninth stage is you experience the citta. A citta is the Buddhist word for the mind. Interestingly, in Sanskrit, it also means like beautiful, delightful. I don't know why they have that same meaning, but it certainly makes a lot of sense when you experience the citta for the first time. Because what actually happens once the breath gets so subtle and disappears and the mind has got enough energy is you see the nimitta. Beautiful light appears in the mind. When that first came up, no one told me that was a citta. I had to work it out for myself. And you think, what the heck is that? This beautiful light which comes up, so radiant, so beautiful at this stage. And I wondered, how am I watching the breath? What am I doing? What is this? And after many years of insight, just experiential insight, you understand that what you are watching, when an nimitta comes up, is a reflection of your mind. You're actually seeing the citta directly. So those of you who want to know what the mind is, those of you who have got all these theories about the mind and the brain have got something to do with each other, and if you want to find out what your mind is, it is at this stage you are literally face to face with your citta, with your mind. But this is interesting, because sometimes when your nimitta comes up, it's all dirty. It's not bright at all, it's got these smudges of grey on it. And if that happens to you, uh-oh, what have I been doing? The point is that you cannot sort of hide the truth from yourself at this stage. You're just seeing yourself, the naked jitter, as it were, as it really is. And you find if you've been compromising your precepts, if you've been really indulgent, sneaking into the kitchen late at night to get something to eat, or whatever it is, you'll find when your nimitta comes up, it's not all that bright. It's just nature, that's all. So don't need to get upset about it. It's just nature. Because that jitter, because it's your, that nimitta, you see, it's a reflection of your jitter. If your jitter is really pure, then that nimitta is really pure. And when it comes up, oh, it's so wonderful, it's so pure, it's so beautiful, it's so rich. And if that comes up and you see one of those, then that you should feel very good. It means that, you know, for the last, you know, few days, you've been living a very pure, good, kind life. Which is, you know, it's why when you die you see that nimitta. Now be careful, if you've lived a very heedless life, that nimitta will be just so disgusting. You'll send you to disgusting places. That's what happens. And it's great when you come on retreats, because I know many people, you know, for over many years, that long-term disciples. And I know their lifestyles reasonably well. Obviously, there's a lot I don't know about you. But, a lot I don't want to know about you. But there are some people that you know are just such pure, kind, good people. And it's great, because I know those people. I know that when they get a nimitta coming up, that nimitta, which is so pure and so blissful, it'll blow them away. Because the power of their nimitta is, you know, they're pure people. They're really kind, good, positive people. People who would never do anything to harm another being. Always kind to animals. Never sort of say a bad word about anybody. Never use bad speech. Always kind and generous. Whenever there's a donation need to be given, they just put it in there straight away. They're just a kind, generous, good people. You know who they are. It's completely selfless. Now, it's time to go on a retreat, and this. Now, they've been on the retreat last time, but somebody really wants to go, oh, you go, take my place. They're just completely selfless. Those sorts of people, when their nimitta comes up, it's just amazing, it's just beautiful. And so as soon as their nimitta comes up, bam, 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 they're straight into jhanas. They don't need to do anything else, because their nimitta is just so powerful. But if a nimitta comes up and it's not that powerful, it means you have to work with it for a while. So it's not all lost. Obviously, the easiest way is just have a good lifestyle, be a really good, pure being. Now, this is where the virtue becomes very important. You can't just meditate and think that you can live a really heedless, selfish, cruel lifestyle and think you're going to get into deep meditation, because the mind is not powerful enough. You've spoiled it. But if you are a really good, kind, you know, helpful, joyful person in life, then when your nimitta comes up, wow. You don't have to do much more. But there is another way. You don't have to have perfect virtue, because once the nimitta comes out, that's called experiencing the citta, the ninth stage. You've got the 10th and 11th stages of anapanasati. How the Buddha said you could work with just ordinary nimittas to take those into jhanas. You call the first one is actually delighting that nimitta, brightening it up. I call it like polishing the nimitta. In other words, it might be a dull one, but you're going to make it brilliant. And the way to do that, there's two ways of doing that. The first way is just allowing it to be, keeping it there for a while. It brightens up by itself after a time. If that doesn't happen, and I mentioned this before, you can look into your nimitta for the bright spot. Somewhere in there, there'll be a spot which is brighter than everywhere else. Even though there may be some dull spots, some dirty spots, don't look at those. Look at what's in between them. The beautiful, the clean, the bright spots. And if you start to see that, it starts to twinkle. And that starts to expand and fill your mind. Just in the way of focusing I mentioned yesterday. That's what you focus on. The beautiful part of the nimitta starts to expand. And then that beautiful part of the nimitta, that has a beautiful part, even more beautiful, stronger part in the middle. The incandescent part. And you go into that. And that way you brighten up the nimitta and it gets brighter and brighter and brighter. You're just choosing the nice parts, that's all. Just like, you know, in the when you have your meal, you choose the nice parts. This is what you do with the nimitta, and that brightens it up. However, sometimes it's bright, but it doesn't last. It comes and goes. And the reason why it comes and goes is because you come and go. The nimitta is just a reflection of your mind. It's like you're looking at yourself in a mirror. And if that image in the mirror is moving backwards and forwards, it means that the one who is watching is moving backwards and forwards. That's why the nimitta moves. That's why the nimitta comes and goes. Because you are coming and going. The one who watches. So the next stage of Anapanasati, according to the Buddha, it's called Samadhang Chitang. It means like stabilizing the nimitta. Really, it's stabilizing the one who watches. So the one who watches, this observer, the knower, mindfulness, at this stage has to become perfectly still. Can't move at all. Because if it moves, your nimitta moves, and you can't go any further. So this, don't try and control the nimitta, which is a big mistake people make. It's moving backwards and forwards. So you actually, as it were, you go out and try and hold it still. The simile which I've given for this, which is by far the most accurate simile, is incredibly, spookily accurate. It's like when you're seeing an image of yourself in a mirror. And that image is moving because you're moving backwards and forwards. And you think it's the mirror's fault. So you go and hold the mirror, thinking that that will make the image go still. And of course it usually makes it move even more. So you don't go and hold the mirror. You put all your attention on this thing which is watching. And you hold that still. The observer becomes still. The other simile, which is again the favorite one of Ajahn Chah, the still forest pool simile. Because this simile concerns the life of the wandering monks many years ago. In a time when you did go wandering because there was places to wander to. Now all those forests have been cut down. So monks don't go wandering so much anymore. If they do go wandering, they don't go wandering in the forests. They will go wandering into the aircraft and into the into the various airports of the world. But nevertheless, in this particular simile, can imagine the jungles. Imagine monks walking from place to place in the jungles, seeking out solitude to meditate, or seeking out dangers to test their inner strength, or seeking out great teachers. And this is what you used to do. And so, when you used to go wandering in the jungles in the forest, it was so sticky, so hot. When it came to about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd always look for a lake or a river, somewhere where you could get some water to drink, to wash, and get ready for the evening. And so having washed, having filled up his water bottle, maybe even washed a couple of robes, Ajahn Chah would retire away from the water hole, maybe about 10, 20 meters, put up his mosquito net umbrella, and then sit meditation throughout the night. But sometimes, he said, he would sit there with his eyes open, and at dusk, the animals would come out to drink. Sometimes tigers, elephants. Now, those tigers and those elephants, they eat people. Even monks, they don't care. So he had to be very still. If he was very still, they'd come out. Some of the other animals were more afraid of men. The men were afraid of the animals. So if he moved, the animals would know, and very often they'd run away. And he couldn't watch them. But sometimes he was very still, just sitting there. Like some of you have sometimes sat in the garden, so still that the birds have come and have eaten something right in front of you. They may even have just landed on your head and pooped on your head. I always like spoiling these good stories with silly cracks. But anyhow, it's only when you're very still will the animals sort of, you know, treat you like that. Because they don't think you're there. The same way when Ajahn Chah was very still, he could watch his animals play and they wouldn't know he was there. And it was just great fun just watching his animals play like that. I've done that a few times as well, just sitting down and watching the animals play, and they don't know you're there. And just, they're just like human beings. I remember putting some water out for the birds every evening in this one monastery. I used to sit there and just watch, absolutely still, so the birds wouldn't even recognize I was close by. And the birds, actually, they had a bit of like culture. They'd actually stand in line, first come, first served. And they'd be waiting in line. You could see which one came first. And when the one in front of them was finished, then they'd go in. But every now and again, it was this sort of rebellious, naughty bird who would come and jump the queue. And as soon as he jumped the queue, all the other birds would get on top of him, beat him up, and send him away. You know, there was a law in the jungle, you know, queuing up, even birds queued up. But anyhow, when Ajahn Chah was very still, he could watch all these animals play. But then he said, this is the important thing about this simile, he said sometimes he was so still that after the ordinary animals had come out to play and gone back into the forest again, he started to see some very strange animals, very weird and incredibly rare. In fact, his teachers, his parents, had never told him such amazing, beautiful animals ever existed. They were so rare that only few beings ever see these. They'd only come out from the jungle to drink by the still forest pool, only when it was absolutely still. And if he moved even a small amount, they would know someone was there, and they'd rush into the jungle, and they would never come out again, sometimes for weeks or months. They were that shy. But often, he knew how to be still, and they'd sniff the air to see if anyone was watching. He was so still, they couldn't detect him. And then they'd come and play. These amazing, rare, most beautiful animals would come and play to his delight on the still forest pool. He'd enjoy every moment of it. Now that simile is once the nimitta is very still, the jhanas might come out and play. But you have to be very still, because they're very rare and they're very wonderful. When you experience one of these things, you think, I never knew such a blissful, beautiful experience could ever exist in this world. No one has told you about it. It's not in any history books. You don't see it on the Discovery Channel. This is very, very rare. And it only comes out when you're absolutely still. When the one who's watching is not moving, even a micron, not even an angstrom. What are the other? I think that says, not even anything at all. It's absolutely still. Forget what's smaller than an angstrom. That's pretty small anyway. Not even a plank width. A plank that's not like, the wooden plank, that's Max Planck. Not even that's the smallest amount in quantum theory. More than that doesn't make sense according to science. But not even... not even that much. Not moving at all. Only then would his beautiful things come out and play by the still forest pool that is your mind. Now the point is here, this is where you have to calm that nimitta down by calming the watcher down. And you calm it by letting go. And you know that you cannot keep it still by grasping it. Makes the water move. Stillness comes through letting go. You let go of doing anything. Still. Absolutely still. Perfectly still. Like the whole universe is now frozen. That's where jhana comes from. From samadhaṃ cittaṃ. Stabilizing that mind. Letting it go. Making it so still and peaceful. Then the jhanas come. You have something which I've called, nicknamed, the ping-pong jhana. The ping-pong jhana is when the jhana comes, wow, and goes immediately. Like a ping-pong. Now you're ping, now you're pong, you're out. Wow. Now, that's just like, you're so still, absolutely still, and a beautiful animal comes out of the forest. And you go, wow. You've moved the mind. And the animal sees it, knows it, and runs away. It doesn't come out again, sometimes for months. So always remember, these are states built on stillness. Doing nothing. Absolute, the frozenness of attention. The knower is very strong. The doer has completely disappeared. That's how jhanas happen. Absolute stillness. You're just watching, observing, not doing anything at all. And that becomes the 12th step of Anapanasati. Vimocchayaṃ cittaṃ literally means freeing the mind. Freeing it from what? Freeing it from controlling. Freeing it from doing. Freeing it from the body and the five senses. Because here, by this time, you can't even feel the body. Not only not feeling the body, but the potential to feel is gone. Someone can hit you, and you won't even recognize it. someone can shout at you and you cannot even hear them. The potential is gone, cut off. You're removed in such a deep state of stillness. That's why you stay in these states for long periods of time. But eventually you emerge from those states. And when you emerge from those states, then you have the 13th, 14th, 15th and 16th stages of Anapanasati. And just like those other stages, this is not something you do. You don't say, oh, now I'm emerged from jhana, what do I do next? This is just what happens next. And a deep experience like that, you cannot help but wondering, wow, what was that when you emerge? The biggest event of your life. You can't just say, oh, it's interesting, and go off to work afterwards. You just have to look at that. It's called reviewing knowledge. And what you start to see is things like impermanence. What disappeared? Sometimes we don't understand impermanence. We think we understand it as just waves on the surface of a lake, rising and falling. That's not real impermanence. Real impermanence is not just the waves going up and down, but the very ocean completely disappearing. Imagine you're on Cottesloe Beach, and you're watching the waves come up and go down. And you're watching there, and you think that's impermanence. Then suddenly you're watching, and the whole ocean disappears. So does all the sand, all the hills, everything, even the sky, completely vanishing, leaving nothing left. That's impermanence. The fading away of all you thought was substantial and real. The cessation of everything. Those are the three next stages of Anapanasati. These are the stages of insight, seeing what these things truly mean. And then the renouncing of everything, especially the renouncing, the giving up of this control of endure. Because you realize that is the cause of suffering. And those are the next four stages of Anapanasati, which I'll talk about when I give a talk on insight. But that's what happens. That's the Buddha's teaching on meditation. Incredibly profound, very deep, going all the way through jhanas, insights, everything. That's why the Buddha said, just doing the Anapanasati is enough to fulfill the Satipatthanas and get you enlightened. Because that's what the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree. Anapanasati. In brief, is another way which the Buddha described it. By bringing up gladness in the mind, then you get this joy. You want to do this. You want to go inside. You want to meditate. Once that joy comes up, you get the next stage is called tranquility of body and tranquility of mind. Many of you have already got that because you can sit so still with ease. You're sitting here and the body is absolutely still, not causing you any problems whatsoever. You're not holding it still like you did when you first started meditation. Just sitting here completely relaxed. And sometimes you look at the body and no aches here, no pains there. It's just completely comfortable. If you notice, you know, when you've got tranquility of body, it's the most comfortable position you ever can be in life. Even in an armchair or in a bed, whatever amount of money you pay for your bed or armchair, you're sitting here and there's no painful feelings, no discomfort. The body is absolutely still. Effortlessly still. It's called tranquility of body. It comes up when you have a bit of joy and interest in the meditation. You're happy inside. If you're not happy inside, very often it sends us out into the body, into the world, doing this, doing that. Mostly as sort of an escapism from the pain of the body or from the disappointments of our mind. We're always doing things to escape. But when we stop doing things, we come in, the body becomes still. Once the body becomes still, the mind has a chance to become still. You start to get this inner happiness, the happiness born of stillness. It's not just stillness by itself is happy, although it's a very delightful thing. Silence is golden and all that. But silence actually makes the seams of gold as well. Just that silence or that tranquility puts all the energy into mindfulness, and happiness starts to grow. This is that stage which the Buddha said, that from tranquility of body and tranquility of mind grows sukha, the inner happiness. Completely a natural phenomena. The more still you are, the more happiness flows. The more you give up, the more happiness you have. It's a saying of the Buddha, which is, it's only in the Jataka tales, but it's just a beautiful simile. The more you give up, the more happiness you have. If you want ultimate happiness, you have to give up everything. Great little saying. The more you abandon, the more you give up, the more you let go, the more happiness you have. If you want ultimate happiness, then let go of everything. That's incredibly profound. And you experience this. You get so still, so peaceful. You get this great inner happiness. The more you let go, the more that happiness increases. Until it snowballs. And what does it snowball into? After happiness, the Buddha said, comes samadhi, the jhanas. Incredible blissful states, all born of letting go. That's why I keep emphasizing, you don't get attached to the jhanas, because they're stages of letting go. They're born of renouncing things, not of gaining things. They're not attainments, they're letting go ments. And this is why this is so pure and so beautiful. And once you get into this, you understand an amazing truth of life. All the bliss, the great happiness of the world, you don't have to work for, you don't have to buy, you don't have to strive for, you don't have to try and gain, you don't have to fight other people for, you don't have to compete for it. Because when it's made of letting go, it's there for everybody. And the more people gain jhanas, it's not this less for other people. There's always heaps for everybody. Not unlike things of the world. Sometimes the pleasures, the happiness of the world, there's a great competition for the slice of the happiness pie. Because that's material things. But the happiness of letting go is just so much inexhaustible supply. The more people who enjoy it, the more there is for others. So there's no competition anymore. Just let go and there it is. So this is a joy which develops samadhi. Samadhi literally is the stillness of the mind. Ekagata, one peak of mind. Not just in space, but in time as well. Just right in the present moment. Boom. In the very heart of the present moment, the very point of the present moment. You're so in the moment that time no longer has a meaning. You can't measure time anymore. There's nothing to measure it with. The moment is all there is. And so this great pain of time, the passing of time, old age, sickness, death, things disappearing, things to do next, all this, what's already passed, what's coming next, it all disappears. Imagine the liberation being free from time. You're just in the timeless present. I really mean timeless. Time has no more meaning. Completely free of that. That by itself is enough bliss for anybody. And here, just one peak, one point in time, in space, in mind. No two anymore. Just this one. And that becomes so blissful and so stable. The most stable states of mind there can be. That's why you last a long time in those stages. Having a great time. And according to this other way of the Buddha teaching, he said once in that samadhi, you've got this gladness leads to this joy leads to this tranquility, tranquility leads to this happiness, the happiness leads to samadhi, the jhanas, and the samadhi leads to seeing things as they really are. These are the insights, the truths. Understanding what real peace is, what joy is, what letting go is. All these things are now part of your experience. No longer theories, but truths you've seen for yourself. That's why they're seeing things as they truly are. And the result of seeing things as they truly are, now you're enlightened. That's what happens. Natural progress. All from just doing a little bit of letting go. That's the Anapanasati Sutta. And also this little progress of the path from all these little things getting into the huge things, or into enlightenment, snowballing. So what starts off as a tiny little snowball has now rolled down the hill so much, this huge, amazing thing called enlightenment. And that's you. So, any questions? Yeah? When you're in a jhana for long periods of time, are you protected from things which are around? According to the theories, they say yes, and it does seem to be the case. And there was this one monk, which I knew when I was a young monk, he was an Indonesian monk. And before he was a monk, he would go into the jungles and just be like a bit of a hermit, and he got this amazing deep experience once, he was telling me about. And he didn't know how long he was in this deep jhana for. But it was days, literally. When he came out afterwards, he noticed the trees were very different. And he asked the villagers around, and sure enough, there'd been a flash flood, which was much higher than him. He'd been completely submersed for, I don't know, for many hours, maybe even days. Didn't know a thing about it. So, certainly, because you're not breathing at that time, you don't need to breathe. So, you know, being covered by water doesn't make any sense, doesn't affect you at all. So, yeah, you are protected in that sense. Sometimes just the purity of it protects you from animals. When animals realize, you know, what is this? This is just something holy, I can't touch this. Oh, this another story has come to mind about this monk who was getting into deep meditation, and when he woke up from his meditation, there was a tiger sitting right next to him, licking him. Yeah, because the tiger, you know, this beautiful little being there, just, you know, in jhana, so he licked him. And of course, a tiger, real tiger, you know. Once it hit you. But if you come out from these states of samadhi, you can't have any fear. It's a tiger. Oh, it's a tiger. Because you're too still, you can't get fear after deep meditation. The mind's got to move to have fear. It's got to start attaching to things to be afraid. So in deep meditation, just whatever happens. Oh, that's interesting. That's all. Okay. I think that's enough entertainment for this morning. So now, instead of listening to it, now to do it. You all have all the instructions so many times. Just get out of the way and let it happen. Go into the timeless now. Who cares what time it is, what day it is, what month it is, what year it is? What age are you? Timeless. So, just let go of all time. Stop measuring time, and time doesn't exist. Stop measuring progress, and the mind can't move anymore. Stop measuring where you are, and you just be here. All control stops. And you'll find all these stages, they happen naturally. You're not doing anything. Sitting here, and all these things are coming to you. Okay? So off you go and do that. Okay, we've got the interviews again this morning. So as in according to, you know, all the rules now. Off you go. If you don't want to come, put your cross by your names. And if you see someone who's crossed their name out, try and come a little bit earlier so we can give people a bit more time. Okay.